originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to, and we are very happy to have you listening throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 201, and all of you tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer or your mobile device. You're doing that, of course, at horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with retired top trainer, the pontiff of the Pick Four himself, that is Jude Feld. We are together in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios and ready to roll for the next hour or so, JT. And, you know, once again, we get a chance to visit with a trainer who is just kind of embarking on that trainer career, which is, you know, always kind of fun when you get to talk to these kind of folks.
Yeah, young trainers are great. They're very optimistic. They haven't had to suffer through the pitfalls that trainers go through. They figure it's all going to be, unicorns and rainbows. But it's always fun to get them started and hopefully learn their stories and teach other people who they are. When you see a new name in the program, sometimes you don't know the person's background, and it's nice to know who they worked for and what their philosophies are.
Speaking of unicorns and rainbows, before we get to our special guest tonight, do want to make sure we extend a very special congratulations to our friend Mark Cassie for winning his very first American Classic race in the Preakness with War of Will last Saturday. Of course, it was a race you heard right here on the network, and I got a chance to stop by the barn at that Preakness party that they have afterwards, and I went by and saw War of Will, saw Mark and his wife Tina. Boy, he was just, he was beside himself because it still hadn't sunk in yet. And he was trying to figure it all out. Tina said it hadn't sunk in for her either, but, it just a glow around Mark Cassie that I haven't seen before. It was really, really pretty cool.
Yeah. He's a very emotional guy and, you know, he loves his horses and he loves the sport. So, he did kind of have that look, after the race on television, you know, and his wife kind of just was standing there. They really didn't look like they witnessed it. You know what I mean? It was kind of cool. And I sent him a text and he was very gracious, texting me back. I'm sure he had a gazillion texts on his phone, but, it was a great day, a fantastic performance by the horse. He looked awesome in the post parade. And so onward to Belmont.
Onward to Belmont for Wow. That's his nickname.
Right.
You knew that, right?
War of Will.
War of Will.
Wow. As a matter of fact, that's
that
how
was
I started.
A wow moment last
that's
Saturday.
That's how
too.
I started my text.
Yeah.
Capital W.
Wow.
Little O. Capital W.
Perfect.
Exclamation point.
Well, listen, Mark certainly at the top of the mountain with that victory. Somebody else who has known the feeling of winning on the big stage is trainer Buff Bradley. And tonight on Trainer Talk, we're going to welcome in his longtime assistant, Matt Hebert, who is, I mentioned, just getting started with his career, went out on his own in 2014. Since that time, he has saddled 204 starters, 36 of those have won, but in 2019, things have really been heating up. 9-43 here this year so far for Matt Hebert, and he is with us now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. You are currently at Lone Star Park, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Lone Star for the first time. Checking it out.
What do you think?
So far, we've won a couple. So, you know, anytime you can win a couple races, you're going to like wherever you're at. So it ain't too bad.
I had horses at Lone Star the first three meets that they had there. My brother was living in Texas at the time, and I trained some horses for him and some of my other clients there. And it was a lot of fun. It's a beautiful facility, and the people in Texas love their racing.
Yeah, they do. They come out. I mean, they support it pretty good. Anytime you lead one over, it's usually a pretty good crowd on the front side. So It's been fun so far, for sure.
Matt, I have never had the privilege to visit Lone Star in all the years we've been doing this. That is one track I have not made it to. Tell me a little bit about it. What's it like?
Well, supposedly it's pretty dry, but since we've been here, it's been quite a bit of rain. The surface seems pretty kind on everything. We haven't had any issues thus far. The turf course looks really good. We haven't had too many chances to run on it. But we've got a couple in this weekend on the turf, so I'm anxious to see what the grass is like.
Are you primarily older horses, or do you have a lot of babies coming up? What's your stable look like?
We probably have 6 2-year-olds. We actually won the first 2-year-old race down here for fillies. They've only ran the one, and it was a horse that we got out of the 2-year-old in training sale down here for Top Hat Thoroughbred. So yeah, we got a mixture. Whatever they want to bring in, honestly, you know, we got babies, we got older horses, we've got fillies, colts, you know, whatever you want to bring in, we can try and train them.
Matt, I mentioned the mark of 9 for 43 this year. That's pretty solid. But if you dig deeper inside the numbers, you see that you have been first, second, or third with your runners in the top three, 23 out of those 43 starts. That's really solid. What's the secret? What's been going on?
I wish I knew so I could do it more often. we try to take good care of them. And honestly, picking your spots. I mean, that's what anybody's going to tell you. You try to put them where they're competitive. And if you find a spot where they're not competitive, then, you know, you look around and do some searching and try to run them where they belong, honestly.
Yeah, sometimes that's a struggle with the owners. Sometimes the owners
absolutely
think
absolutely
their horses are better than they are.
Yeah, and we've kind of, you know, I've gone through some owners that, you know, were kind of tough to get along with or this or that, but you kind of just weed out the ones that you're able to work with, and that's what we've done for the past couple of years, and I think it's kind of paying off, you know, over the winter mostly.
Yeah, I think it's you know, finding a girlfriend or a boyfriend. You know, you got to have common goals and similar philosophies, and sometimes people just don't mesh. And I think a lot of times, you know, owners, they get in a rush to get a trainer, and they look at the standings and see who's in there, and then they're with that person for a while, and they realize, you know, this just isn't working out for me. And if you take some time and go to a trainer's barn and talk to them and you know, really find out what their philosophy is and find out if it meshes with what you want to do, everybody's happier that way.
Sure, absolutely. And it's trial and error, you know. Like you said, there's people you're going to get along with and people you do business a little bit better with than others. And it's, you know, I don't try to take anything personal, which is hard to do sometimes in this game. But, you know, you find the ones that you work well with, and, you know, you hear everybody tell you it only takes one or two good ones. And honestly, it's probably true. If you can catch one or two people that are loyal to you and, you know, keep restocking your stalls and making your life a little easier.
Matt, talk about some of those owners that have supported you since you've gone out on your own.
Well, Buff gave me my start, man. Buff gave me, when I told him I wanted to go out on my own, he gave me three horses, three homebreds from Frankfort, Kentucky, off the farm, and said, good luck. And, you know, and I had no idea how tough it was going to be. I mean, I've picked up people here and there. Right now we've got Susan Moulton, who's from down here, and I've got 22 in training, and I think about 10 of them are hers. And that was just I picked up a horse named Super Wonderful that Windstar was giving away because she'd never make it to the races. And Susan's current farm manager got me the filly, and I think we won 5 or 6 with her. So it was just one of those things where we happened to do well with one horse, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
Well, you mentioned not knowing how tough it was going to be when you started down this road. What was the biggest challenge that you had to overcome?
Picking up owners, man. Picking up owners. And, you know, we picked up people that backyard breeders that had one mare and one horse a year, and, you know, we made do for 3 years with those horses before we started really And we won with him. You know, we put him in the right spot. We did pretty well. But getting clientele and keeping clientele, keeping them happy is super tough. I mean, the lifestyle is tough enough, moving around and, you know, not knowing where you're going to be. But honestly, that part is easy compared to picking up and keeping business.
Yeah, it's so hard for a small stable when you want to have all your horses in one place, and maybe it's not some place that your client wants to race. Maybe they live in another state or whatever. So it's difficult. You're constantly having to try to change horses around or change people's minds as to where they want to race.
Oh, it's absolutely. And I spent the first couple years at training centers, and it gave me the freedom to kind of, in Lexington, Kentucky. So I was pretty central. I could ship to Indiana, to Mountaineer if I had to River Downs in Ohio. You know, I could pick my spots pretty carefully along the way. And, you know, we went to Houston this winter, and I had a pretty good string that I thought would be competitive there, and we did pretty well. And, you know, you just try to improve your stock. You got to have the horses that can win wherever you're at.
Matt, how does the conversation go when you start talking to a prospective new owner about sending you horses? What do you want them to know about you and your operation?
Just that we try to put, you know, it depends how green they are, you know, because I've talked to some people that are super green and have no idea, like, how it works. And those guys, you know, you just tell them, hey, don't spend your mortgage on this horse. You know, if you've got a little bit of money and you want to have fun and have a good time and try to win some races, then, you know, I don't try to sell it. I'm not a good salesman. I'm not a salesman kind of guy. So I'm not trying to sell them anything. I just try to tell them if it's, you know, if you like the game and maybe you like the bet or you like the animals, then, you know, you might be able to have some fun. And then the people that know, they're easier. You know, you just, if you can agree on when and where to run, as long as you're getting results. I mean, obviously winning makes everything better, but yeah, just don't bet the farm if you're afraid to lose it, I guess.
that's good advice. I had some ladies that mortgaged their house to claim a horse one time.
Oh my God.
Talk about pressure. I think that was the most pressure I ever felt as a trainer, because I figured, you know, these women could lose their house.
How did it run?
They ended up winning a race with it, and they got out. But, man, oh, man, that was a lot of pressure.
Yeah, man, that's tough. If somebody's not eating dinner, if the horse runs third instead of second, then yeah.
Yeah, it's bad enough for the trainer, right, because you chose that lifestyle. But oh, man. Yeah, for sure.
And it's one thing when you're convincing people. I mean, you want to convince them to get into it, you know, but, like, I don't want to sell them an arm and a leg and tell them, oh, for sure, it's a money-making guarantee, you know. It's tough to sell it like that, especially when they don't run good.
Right.
Yeah, and it is a lot of pressure on the trainer because you feel like you're responsible for what's going to happen, even though in a lot of ways you can't control the outcome once the gates spring open. Everything is out of your hands, which we've talked to other trainers about that in the past. You know, you can do everything right, and then the horse comes out of the gate and something happens that you can't control. How do you deal with those things?
It's going to happen. You know, stuff like that is going to happen out of your control. Just control the things that you can, that you're able to. I mean, put the work in. You can look around and tell the guys that are here staying at the barn all day that they know their horses. So I would just say, I mean, work as hard as you can, honestly. Put the work in, and it's something that, I mean, if you're clipping at 25%, then you're doing really well, but it means you're losing three-quarters of the time. So that stuff is going to happen. I mean, and I'm a pretty sore loser. You know, I'll bake on a loss for a couple of days. But just know it's going to happen. No difficult stuff is going to pop up, and you either deal with it or you don't.
Bake on a loss for a couple of days. You're doing a lot of baking, my friend.
Yeah, man. I take it hard. Like I said, you shouldn't take it personal, but anytime I have one run bad, I take it pretty personal. And you're second-guessing everything, you know. Oh, I should have worked them 7 days out instead of 6 days, or, you know, stuff that probably, I mean, it matters, but is it the difference between a win and a loss? I don't know.
Bobby Frankel made a suggestion to me one time about blowing a horse of mine out in the morning that she was running, and I did, and the horse won. And I went to his barn, and I thanked him for the advice, and he said, I don't care what you did with her the morning of the race. She was going to win anyway.
Exactly.
I thought that was funny, but yeah, does your help have to hide out behind the straw pile and all that when you're in a bad mood?
No. I'm pretty quiet about it. I don't talk much anyway, so it's pretty internal.
How do you celebrate the wins?
I usually don't by thinking I got to wake up at 3:30 the next morning.
Wow. Now, wait a minute. Now, if you're going to beat yourself up over the losses, which are inevitable in this sport, you mentioned losing 75% of the time.
Sure.
That's probably good enough to get you into the Hall of Fame if you're winning the right races, believe it or not.
Yeah.
You got to celebrate the good times, don't you?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll drink beer from time to time. So it's either you're drinking your sorrows away or you're drinking out of celebration.
There you go.
Talking with Matt Hebert, who is our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here tonight. Don't forget, if you miss any portion of the show, just head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure. It's there for you at horseracingradio.net. You know, Jude mentioned the pressure of training for somebody that mortgages their house to get involved in this sport. What's the most pressure or the most anxiety you've ever had before starting a horse, Matt?
Oh, every single one of them, man. I'm nervous as could be for a nickel non-two at Belterra. I've got a horse, a nice filly in Monday, and 100,000 on the turf. I'm more nervous for the one that just ran second, or no, I'm sorry, third for 75. I get nervous for every single one. I used to get nervous for church basketball, man. So. Like, I don't sit down and watch a race. I'm pacing the whole time.
Are you a superstitious guy?
Very, very, extremely.
So what are your race day superstitions?
In Houston, I had a spot. I'll try a different spot to see which one hits. But we found a spot in Houston where I sat down. I took a sip of my buddy's beer. I said, it's all right, because it was a beer I never tasted. Handed it back. And then watch a race, and then that was, and we had to get the beer from the same spot. We tried it at a different spot, and we ran off the board. So, it was the same thing every time.
I'm clear on that.
Sounds like you.
Yeah, clear on that. I have to go if I'm winning. I have to go to the same teller every single time.
Exactly.
I have to use the same pen every time I go to the racetrack. I've even been known to go to the same urinal if I'm on a hot streak.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
The late Tim yeah. Conway was like that. He had a lucky urinal at Santa Anita.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm telling you.
I haven't pinned it down to which bathroom I use, but I'll look for it next time we run one. Yeah.
So you go through that same routine as long as you're winning. Do you,
sure.
When, at what point do you actually say, okay, I'm switching it up, we need a new routine?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it probably takes a couple. It takes a couple. And even then, you got to ride it out, you know, because you know it's coming.
As long as you can drop one in, you're all right.
Exactly. As long as you can drop one. Well, that's just it. I mean, you go on a losing streak, and you start getting pretty aggressive with where you run them.
You know, earlier you mentioned keeping owners happy, and that was a big key to being successful as a horse trainer. How do you do it? How do you keep every owner happy?
You can't. I mean, if you did, you'd have every owner in the world. But honestly, you know, I try to be as honest as possible. And some people want to hear it, and some people don't. And the people that do, you can work with. The people that don't, you know, those are the ones that you, I mean, you can lie to them and tell them their horse is a world beater and this is going to happen and that's going to happen. And then, you know, you run them and they run off the track. And then where does it leave you? If you can kind of tell them, hey, this horse is going to, you know, you want to run it straight maiden. I want to run maiden 15. And, you know, it's communication, which is not my strongest suit, and it's honesty. If you can do that, I find that it makes everybody's life a lot easier.
Yeah, there's a fine line. I mean, sometimes you like a horse and your enthusiasm, it becomes infectious to the client. And then when the horse maybe doesn't perform up to expectations, because we all know that happens, Sure. The clients still think that horse is all world, and you have to adjust. It's a day-to-day thing. I mean, horses can be one way this week and another way the following week. So it's
managing expectations is a huge part of the gig, I find. You know, just you want to keep people pumped, you want to keep them enthused, but you don't want to like make it too much. You know, you don't want to trick them into thinking they got something that they don't. So it's a fine line.
Yeah, and I think it's as much about educating the owners as the owners educating the trainers. You have to find that balance, and that's what makes it all work. I mean, you're going to run into owners that think that every single horse that they have is the next Secretariat, right?
Whether you know, even I ran into them.
Yeah.
I ran into them.
Sure. Sure, it's common, right? That does happen, and then you'll get the owners, and it's kind of refreshing when you get the owners that say, you know what? You're right. This horse really isn't much. Let's run him for where he belongs and not try to push the horse into a level that he just doesn't fit.
Music to my ears. Music to my ears. When they say, all right, be aggressive, and you're like, oh, all bets are off. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now you have a chance. It's always funny, too, because it's the young trainers that have to educate the clients, and then they eventually get fired, and the client takes the horse to the Hall of Fame trainer, and then they do exactly what that guy says, which is what you told them in the first place, but
exactly.
They don't remember that, you know?
Well, those guys have a little bit more clout, and, you know, the more you do this, the longer you're able to stay in business, you can kind of tell, like, if there's been times when I've had three horses, and I'm putting up with people that are difficult to get along with, to say the least. Whereas now, you know, you got a little leeway, you got 20, maybe you don't need this one person that's calling you, begging, you know, telling you're doing this and you're doing that wrong. So, and those guys, you know, you look at Hall of Fame guys and you got 150 horses in training. What's one idiot with one cheap horse, you know? You can kind of, it's a fine line, you know?
Well, you learn from the very best. In that respect, with Buff.
Buff was a good dude. Buff and my dad actually both worked for Clarence Piku in Louisiana. And when Buff went out on his own, my dad went with him. And that's how we ended up in Kentucky.
He is Matt Hebert. I can say that name. Matt Hebert, right? I got it right. Of course, we're here in Kentucky, so can I go with Hebert?
Hebert is better than Herbert, as long as that extra R ain't in there.
How often did you get that? You were here in Kentucky. You grew up here. How often did you get it as Hebert?
Let me tell you, I spent a lot of time. My dad's Cajun, right? So I spent quite a few years in speech therapy, and he had to show up to school and say, this is why he talks like this.
Oh, it's great. Well, I know we're kind of working from the most recent backwards, but this show is as much about you, the person, and how you got started in the business as it is about what you're doing currently. So let's go back to the beginning, Matt. Where did it all begin for you?
Well, both my parents were on the track, so we've been around it. I have a younger brother who's 2 years younger. He's a horse dentist. But we've been around it forever. I didn't start taking it seriously until I dropped out of art school at UK and I needed money to eat. So I went to break babies for my dad, and that's kind of where it started.
So before that, you weren't even interested in getting into the family business, so to speak?
Not at all, man. Not at all. Like middle school, high school, it was sports and girls and very little about actual horses.
What sports did you play?
I actually ran in college for a little while. I ran track and cross country. I played some basketball, but I'm a small white dude, so it was all hustle and heart. A little baseball, a little soccer, just whatever, anything, honestly.
Well, it helps to be fit when you're training, because you do a lot of walking in the mornings. You might be doing up to 10 miles a day, so you probably get around the track pretty quick.
I wish I was just walking. I just got on 8 this morning, and my legs are wobbly. If all I had to do was walk back and forth, then I'd be sitting pretty.
8? Do you do that every day?
No, I just had a rider quit, man. I've been sitting on the pony for the past winter or so, but she quit a couple days ago, so it's back in the saddle for me.
It's amazing how much fitness you can lose in a short period of time like that, isn't it?
Oh, I was gassed today. I've been on eight the past 3 days, and it's been, you know, when you're 20, 21, like you get 30 a day and just go all day and it'd be no problem. But now after, you know, you take a couple months off and you're like, holy cow, this is a little tough.
When did you start riding?
We learned to ride early on. I didn't start galloping until I was 19. I'm 34 now, so however long ago that was.
15 years.
15 years. Yeah. Math is not my strong suit.
Seems like 30.
Seems like 35.
Matt Hebert with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phase of Tipton. I just wanted to make sure I got his name right that time, yeah. So I had to say it again. So what was the conversation like when you called your dad and you said, hey, you know what, I'm going to drop out of college and I'm going to get into the horse business?
I called my mom first. I called my mom crying. And she was good. She was kind of an outside-of-the-box thinker anyway, and she knew I wasn't happy in school, so... So she said, go for it. And, of course, my dad wanted free help, so he was all for it, too.
Wait, he wasn't paying you?
Oh, my God. No, we were learning for 5 years. And then, I mean, he had to pay us a little bit eventually. But, I mean, he got free to almost free labor for as long as he could.
Yeah, one of my first jobs on the racetrack was for a guy whose father – was a dentist, and he had five horses, and he never paid his training bill. So I was financing the dinners and stuff because I was working for the Daily Racing Form in the afternoon and working for the trainer in the morning. So we got by on what I was making, but that's a tough deal. when your dad's your best client.
Yeah, it is.
Why'd you decide on art school?
Because I'm halfway decent and I didn't have a clue what I was doing, honestly. I've got some family members that are pretty good artists and it was somewhat interesting. But really because I had no idea. I had no clue what I was doing.
Yeah, drawing, painting, drawing, what's your specialty?
Yeah, I've drawn, I read a lot of comic books. So that was a thought for a minute. Try to make it as a comic book artist. I don't know which one is harder, trainer or comic book artist, but we went down this path.
Did you ever meet Seth Benzel?
No, I haven't.
Because, you know, he's a very accomplished artist now. He's got his own studio. He travels all over the world. He had a show in Dubai and stuff. He used to be Todd Pletcher's assistant at one time.
Yeah,
he gave it all up for the art world, and he's become a very popular artist.
Well, if I gave it all up for the art world, I would probably starve. So we're probably doing the right thing here.
We are coming up against our break here at the bottom of the hour, Matt, but we're going to invite you to stay with us. Real quick before I let you go, your favorite comic book, what is it?
Oh, X-Men, without a doubt.
All right, well, there you go. It's music to the ears of our producer over here, too. He's a big fan.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. All right, Matt Hebert is our guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. We're going to be back second half of the program. Stay with us right here on HRN.
Nominate now to the 2019 Phasic Tipton Selected Yearling Sales. The July sale, July 9th and 10th in Lexington, Kentucky. The Saratoga sale, August 5th and 6th in Saratoga Springs, New York. And the New York Bred Yearling sale in Saratoga, August 11th and 12th. Recent greatest stakes graduates of the Phasic Tipton Selected Yearling Sales include Mind Your Biscuits, Dream Tree, Rushing Fall, Mopetism, Sipican Harbor, Stormy Liberal, and many more. Nominate now the Phasic Tipton Selected Yearling Sales. Stronger than ever.
Bloom Racing.
Sky Diamonds takes the lead. Sky Diamonds to win, going away.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Midnight Bizu with another assertive final furlong. The top filly of the meet deservedly wins the Grade 1 Santa Anita Oaks.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
I think the WIN program is a very positive and important thing for breeders, because if a stud farm supports the breeders that support their stallions, that's an important thing to me. I want to know that the stud farm also has the breeders' interests in their mind. This year we had a mare that we wanted to breed to a stallion that we thought might be a little bit over her budget, but when we realized that we had the WIN awards for our business plan, it worked perfectly into getting that mare to that stallion at WinStar.
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, exactly how do the Flair strips work?
Mike, remember that a horse only breathes through its nose when it's running. About 50% of the resistance to getting the oxygen through the nose and into the lungs is at the nasal passages. They're the narrowest part of the upper airway, and that's where Flair strips work. The strips are proven to help prevent the nasal passages from collapsing, so horses breathe easier and get the oxygen they need more efficiently.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
They come to the top of the lane. Teddy's Promise on the inside. Groupie Dollar's right there. Dance Card the Grey on the outside. Sweet Lulu tries to hang tough along the inside as well. Groupie Doll hanging on. Judy the Beauty's come back at them as well. And Dance Card on the outside. But it's Groupie Doll. Groupie Doll, Dance Card, Judy the Beauty going to hit it together. Groupie Doll along the inside. Groupie Doll, Judy the Beauty. Groupie Doll in a thriller. Groupie Doll beats Judy the Beauty. Dance Card was third. Summer Applause running on late to be in a photo with Sweet Lulu for fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. That was Trevor Denman with the call of the Philly and Mare Sprint, and that was at Santa Anita in 2013. And what a moment it was for Groupie Doll, her second victory in the Philly and Mare Sprint, and what an amazing filly she was. She would go on to win 12 of 23 lifetime starts, more than $2.6 million in earnings, and she was one of our favorites because of our friendship with Buff Bradley. We welcome back to the program his longtime assistant, Matt Hebert. And Matt, that call, I know you told me during the commercial break that if we play the call of her second Breeders' Cup win, it just gives you chills every time. How about now?
It does. And honestly, I just got goosebumps and chill and teared up a little bit, being perfectly honest.
That was a heck of a day. I mean, I remember that day like it was yesterday. Cashed a big exacta because Wesley Ward's a friend of mine. So it was
Judy the Beauty. Yeah.
Judy the Beauty and Buff and Rajiv and all that stuff. Fantastic.
What made Groupie Doll so special?
Being the fastest filly in the country for a couple of years.
I mean, what was she like to be around? What made her that? Did she have that it factor?
Honestly, she is, if not the, then one of the most laid-back horses I've ever been around. She's one of the very few horses I've ran that you didn't put a lip chain on. Just a shank around the nose, no problem, no dancing, no, like, being goofy, just took it all in stride. That calmness, man, that just calm kind of vibe was very unique and something I haven't seen, honestly, since then. And she was super fast, so that plays a big part in it, too.
It's pretty unique for a really good filly to be so laid back. Usually they're kind of, not easy to deal with.
Especially a sprinter, too. Especially a sprinter.
Yeah, she was ultra-talented. Were you around Groupie Doll for her entire career?
Yeah, actually, my dad broke her. We used to break all of Buff's babies, and she came through. And when someone asked him later about Groupie Doll, he said, "Who?" Because she was just kind of a run of the mill, like, you know, didn't do anything bad, so she's probably not going to stick out to you as a baby. But yeah, we were in the barn. I went to work for Buff, I think, when she was at, I want to say, they left her in Kentucky, and we were down in Gulfstream. So we came back, and yeah, she was there.
I remember standing at Keeneland with Buff when she sold, and we watched the bids, you know, come in, and it got to $1 million, and everybody applauded. And then it got to $2 million, and everybody applauded. Then it got to $3 million, and the place went crazy. And the emotion that came out of Buff was one of the moments I'm never going to forget. And anything that we've done over the years, standing next to him, and the emotions that came out of him when he said goodbye to Groupie Doll, it was incredible.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was a homebred. that was out of a mare that, you know, I don't think she produced anything else. You know, she was Bob Bowman's band, who, what, he was standing for 5,000, if that, at that point. So it was cool to have a homebred like that that was that talented and meant that much to, you know, not only the Bradleys, but the entire barn. You know, when you have that big horse in the barn, like, it makes everything so much easier, the work you're putting in. When you got something like that to lead over, it makes your life pretty good.
What were the other big horses that you had a chance to be around when you were working with Buff?
Brass Hat was at the end of his career when I was galloping for Buff, and I got on him at the end. Divisadero just came into the barn, I think, when I was going out on my own. And then all those homebred mares, you know, that he kind of built around, they were all kind of coming and going throughout that.
Talk about his operation and the homebreds. I mean, it's so difficult to do what he does, and they do it at such a high level, it's really kind of an amazing situation.
I think it takes a little bit of horsemanship. You know, I mean, he's out there, he's at the farm, he's foaling mares, and, you know, it's hands-on and boots on the ground. So I think being that involved in any operation probably breeds a little bit more success than if you're not around, you know. So I would say just the horsemanship level to it, and it's yours, you know, it's your family, it's your farm. Like, you want to do well. It's not something you're just signing off on and, oh, I hope we have a runner this year. It's, man, I hope we have a runner this year so we can put the kids through college.
Yeah, you know, I love the word that you just used, horsemanship. And we've talked about that on this program over the years. And there are trainers that are simply trainers, and there are trainers that are more on the side of horsemen. And either way works. They both are successful. But they're two different animals. Talk about the difference.
Well, I mean, it's just, I don't know. Some people are really good at certain things. Like, there's trainers that are really good at selling you shares of this horse, and they know this guy, and they know that bloodstock guy, and they're going to get the horses in. And if that's your strength, then by all means, you know, play to it, do your thing. But I'm probably more of the horseman, where I'm in the barn constantly, and just, you know, you do the best with the horses you got. I think horsemanship helps you get the most out of all your stock, probably.
Yeah, because, you know, the clients come and go and the horses come and go, but if you can take that blank canvas, so to speak, when you get it, and you know what to do with it, and you can mold the horse in any way that you want, that makes a huge difference down the line.
I agree. And we try to break. I like to develop young horses. You know, it's fun and it's very rewarding to get something that doesn't have a clue and kind of turn them into a professional athlete. I mean, because that's what they are. You know, they're athletes, and to turn something that has no idea what's going on into a cold-blooded runner is a lot of fun.
What things are you looking for in a young horse that will tell you that horse can run?
At this point, I'm looking for a horse that whoever wants to bring one in.
Four legs.
If they're breathing, they're good.
I haven't got to call too many of them quite yet.
What are the characteristics, though, that Matt Hebert looks for when you're looking at a young horse and you say, you know what, I like this, I like this, I like this, I think this horse can be a runner?
Well, the two-year-old we picked up here at the Breeze Up sale, I think the bullet was like 10 and 2. She went 10 and 4, but it was super steady. You know, you saw some go a little quicker, but it was a little, I wouldn't say like a hitch or a step, but it was really steady. And then we went back to the barn to look at her. She was, you know, the sale here at Lone Star, you got people driving and stuff going on, and, you know, it's a lot for a young horse, but she seemed to take it all in stride. So I figured it was one I could kind of push on a little bit, physically and mentally. and she would probably hold up, and she did. So calmness, I mean, certainly helps. I mean, everybody wants the athlete, you know, the biggest and the best looking and, you know, et cetera. But she just, I mean, people will say, oh, you look at the eye and the eye will tell you, but it's kind of true.
It's interesting too, how, you know, you see these horses all the time that they don't bring much money at this sale or that sale, and they'll be in a grade three or grade two with some really top class horses, and they perform just as well. I mean, they don't know what you pay for them, and sometimes maybe the horse isn't the best looking horse, but they got that tremendous heart that you need to perform at a top level.
No, for sure. And you know, heart counts for so much, and it's something that you can't, I mean, the want to win, you know, just horses that'll lay it down for you. And there, I don't think there's a whole lot of ways to measure it. You just, once you get them going, you can kind of figure out who's got it and who doesn't. I've had super talented horses with no heart that just weren't interested in running. And then I've got, you know, horses running for 15 that will lay it down for you every single time. And I'll take a horse with heart over talent, probably 9 times out of 10. I would love to have both, you know, don't get me wrong, but heart counts for a lot.
Yeah, you know, they say that about human athletes too, right? I mean, the person that might not be the most physically imposing that has a bigger heart can accomplish an awful lot of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Work ethic, you know, and horses don't, I mean, they're not putting in a time card, but you know the ones that'll work for you every day and the ones that won't, for sure.
Matt, when you look at your statistics on Equibase, I talked about some of the career stats and the stats from this year, but you go back through and it shows that in 2009, you had 5 starters, a win, and a second from those 5 starters, but that was 5 years before you really launched your own career. So what was happening in 2009?
I was working for people, and I just had a horse or two for myself. And just kind of learned what was how to run horses and how to pick spots. I think the first one I ever saddled won by like 8 and paid a good bit of money and everybody bet it. So yeah, they were mine and I was trying to scrape enough money to feed them.
Wow. Your first starter, your first winner. Were you kind of spoiled at that point?
I went back to the test barn. It was at River Downs in Cincinnati. I went back to the test barn, and the guy says, easy game. I was like, oh, yeah.
I got that figured out, but you waited another 5 years to go out on your own.
Yeah, and I galloped for some people. I went to work for Buff and learned how to train, honestly, learned how to run a barn, learned how to talk to people. You know, to say we're still learning is – I mean, you better be learning something every day because if you're not, the guy in the bar next to you is.
Yeah, Richard Mandela found that out during Kentucky Derby week. I mean, every day there's something new, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not so good. Talk about the difference, though, between the horses and the business. I mean, running the business is at least half of what you have to do as a trainer, and a lot of times that gets lost in the shuffle.
Oh, I hate it, too. I hate paperwork. I hate, you know, all the stuff, the insurance and the workers' comp and the, you know, the taxes and all the stuff that if I could pay somebody, well, not that if I could afford to pay somebody to do it all for me, then I would very happily pay somebody and then just do the barn stuff. I'll clean a stall for 30 minutes rather than sit on the phone and do paperwork that I should be doing.
Yeah, but you have to do those kind of things if you're going to be successful, right?
The first person I hired was a bookkeeper, so yeah.
Yeah, no, you have to. If you know, that's what people outside people will look at horse trainers and they'll say, okay, this person trains horses for a living. They don't realize that you're also running your own business.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, financing. You know, you're paying help. It's a lot. It's a lot on your plate. You know, and it's easy to get overwhelmed. You just try to have good people around you, you know, that can help you out if and when you need it and get it done.
A lot of times people don't realize, too, that the trainer's putting up you know, the first month's training and then may not get paid for another month. So you're actually footing the bill for those horses for a couple months before you even see the first check.
Yeah, you're fronting the money. And there's been times when I've gone from four horses to 20, you know. So you're putting up the money for three times, four times the horses you've got. And then you're praying that they pay you on time. Because if they're not paying you for 6 or 8 weeks, then you're, I mean, it's money out of your pocket, assuming you got some in there.
Wait, how many horses do you ideally want to have, Matt?
Oh, man, it's a numbers game. I'll take 200 in training as soon as I can get them.
How will you manage that?
Help. And, you know, honestly, if I could have, I don't know, I say 200, but I've never come close to that number, so I might be biting my tongue if and when it ever gets there. But just having good people that work for you, people you trust, people you can lean on. And you mentioned Sam Walkson earlier. He's actually down here helping me. And somebody like that, that is that experienced and knows the game, is a huge plus for me.
Yeah, and you mentioned the learning aspect of going out on your own, starting your own business. It's like that, not just with horse training, but it's like that with any business. And you'll make mistakes and you'll learn from those mistakes, but you have to learn. And you said that, you know, if you're not the one learning and paying attention every single day, you know that the other guys and their operations are. So you've got to do that.
Absolutely.
To keep up. If you could sit down and talk with any one trainer, you can go to dinner one night and talk with any one trainer, what trainer is it going to be?
Charlie Windham, probably.
Yeah?
Probably.
How come?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the GOAT, you know? So anything that guy could tell you, he could tell you the sky is blue and the grass is green, and I'd be writing it down.
Excellent choice.
Thank you. I mean, he just, those old-timer guys, you know, it's tough to, it's a lot of stuff you don't see anymore. Just, and the level of horsemanship, again, that level of horsemanship is through the roof, so that would probably be him for sure.
Yeah, I remember I bought a horse at the two-year-old training sale for $275,000. My client got a little crazy. He was trying to impress his girlfriend and overbid and beat out Bruce Headley and Dwayne Lucas. That's never a good thing, right? When you beat those two guys out, and so the horse he was so studdish, and he, you know, he just act up every time we took him to the paddock. So I went to Charlie. I said, "What do I do with this horse?" And Charlie says, "Cut him." I said, "Well, I gave $275,000 for him." He goes, "That's not a lot of money." And boy, was he right. He was so
right. It's all relative, right?
Yeah, it's great. But he was, you know, he of a lot of trainers on the backside who were very accomplished and stuff, I think he was one of the best at sharing his knowledge with young trainers. He'd give them a little bit of a hard time, but he was very, very good at helping people out and explaining things to them, and always seemed like he had enough time to talk to you. He was never.
That's super cool, man. Yeah. That makes my pick even better, just hearing stuff like that. That's
Jude,
super cool.
Isn't he the one you told me about the quote that he had regarding owners?
Yes.
Was that Charlie Whittingham?
Charlie Whittingham, yes. I'm sure Matt would appreciate it. He said they should be treated like mushrooms, kept in the dark and covered with piles of manure, for lack of a better word.
I wish I could do that. I wish I could just Bobby Frankel them and tell them they're not allowed to the barn or don't call before 10:30. Nah, I'm joking. I get along with them great.
I was in Bobby's barn one day, and a guy hadn't paid his bill like in 3 months or something, and Bobby was raking him over the coals on the phone. It was so entertaining, and he says, I know you go to the turf club and you tell all your friends that Bobby Frankel's your trainer and you're not even paying me. He shamed the guy into writing him a check. So it was great.
Right, or at least he got his money out of him.
Yeah, he was very good about that.
Talking with Matt Hebert, who is our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Matt, what are some of the things that guys like Charlie Whittingham, some of the old-time trainers, would do that you said you don't see that much anymore?
Stuff just like spider bandages, man. I had to go, the first time I saw a spider bandage, I didn't have a clue what it was, and I was at the Spectrum in Louisville, and I went to the old groom, and he showed me how to cut one, showed me how to put it on. But it's just stuff like that that you don't see. I don't know why you don't see it. Little things like that. Just paying attention to your horses. I think Charlie started everything on the dirt three quarters, first two starts, right?
Yeah.
Even if you know you got a route horse, even if you know you turf horse, give him that experience. Let him learn a little bit. And I stay pretty solid on that. Even if we think we got something that's not a dirt sprinter, just giving him those first couple starts, just as a positive learning experience, I think it makes a huge difference in a horse's longevity. You know, just to try to keep their head good and keep them enjoying life. Stuff like that.
Yeah, that foundation, very important, and he was never in a rush, always took his time. So giving a horse two sprints was no big deal for him. He figured he was going to be around a lot longer. So just very, very patient. And I remember one time when I was a young trainer, I asked him why he didn't put blinkers on Ferdinand. He says, because he doesn't need them. Smack down.
That's good.
You're bringing back a lot of memories for me talking about Charlie. He was awesome.
Maybe you'll have to sit down with Jude instead. He'll go to dinner with you, and you can just talk about Charlie all night long. Share some of the secrets that he learned back in the day.
I would love to hear. All that kind of stuff, man, you just need to soak up, because it could be any little thing, you know, you might hear and be able to replay one day in a certain situation that is, and it could be make all the difference in the world.
Well, Matt, this show is obviously sponsored by Phasic Tipton. Do you get a chance to spend much time at the horse sales to kind of look for the next future star for your stable?
I just started picking up some owners that are salespeople. So we were at the two-year-old sale here. I've been looking around. We'll be up at Keeneland in September. We'll be at Phasic. So, yeah, I walk around and pretend like I know what I'm doing.
What are you looking for when you're looking for those young horses? What characteristics?
Something that can breathe.
Back to that again.
Yeah, but I mean, in all honesty, if you're scoping, and I know it's a relative thing when vets scope horses, but something with a good pipe and sound, you know, you can. I know they all look good, and you can forgive a couple things here and there, but sound, being able to breathe is fairly important, I think.
Do you have a favorite sire or two that you might lean toward?
Actually, I've got a mare that I just bred to Golden Sense, and it's a little L.A. bred colt. So, when you're looking for value, some of those young, fast ones I think are pretty good. And if they stretch out, great. If it's a one-turn horse, then at least you know it's going to be quick.
You know, Golden Sense could definitely go a mile, so, you know, you
yeah,
get the best
and
of
he
both
ran,
worlds.
I mean, yeah, I love Golden Sense. When Doug O'Neill had him, man, I love that horse. We actually beat him with Groupie Doll in the Cigar Mile, and I was pretty pumped about it.
That's right. I forgot that she won the Cigar Mile.
Second. Stay Thirsty beat us, and then she got a
rough okay.
And came back and ran. That's on the bucket list.
Okay.
I guess
that's why I forgot she did. She never did.
Yeah. The Cigar Mile, man. I want that one pretty bad.
There you go. Okay. So the bucket list. You got a couple of things you want to accomplish moving forward. What are they?
I mean, everybody wants a Derby. Everybody wants a Classic, you know. I just want to stay in business for another year and then go from there.
good short-term goal.
Short-term and long-term.
All right, so you can – I asked you about going to dinner with a trainer. You can spend a day with any X-Men superhero character. Who's it going to be?
All right. Well, my favorite is Wolverine, but he's generally a pretty grouchy guy. Any X-Men character? Colossus, Peter Rasputin, he likes to drink a couple of beers, so I'll probably go with him.
that's a good call.
Oh, wait, you grew up in Kentucky. It's beer, not bourbon?
No, I can't do bourbon, man. I can't do it. I'll drink beer all day, but bourbon is a little too much for me.
You bleed blue or you bleed red?
Oh, blue, absolutely. Buff would shoot me if I said anything else.
We don't want that to happen.
No. He'd drive from Kentucky to Texas and say, I got my Kentucky hat in the truck, actually. So Yeah, it's all UK for me.
Do you get to go to many games, or are you too busy now?
No, no. When we're in Lexington, I've spent the past couple of years in Lexington. So, yeah, we'll go. I'll catch a football game here and there. You know, I haven't been to a basketball game in years. But, yeah, as much as we can, you know, if I can catch an afternoon off, then I would love to go catch a game.
All right, how about pro sports team? You follow pro sports at all, or is it just college?
No, basketball. I'm a big basketball guy. Like, the playoffs are going on right now. So I watch that, you know, pretty nightly, I'd say.
Who's your favorite team?
You know, I don't have one. There's no team to pull for in Kentucky. Everybody likes, you know, Indiana is there. But if I had to pick a team, I couldn't tell you. I like Milwaukee in the East for the rest of the playoffs. They've kind of gone the slow burner and built a team around Giannis. So I'm kind of pulling for Milwaukee right now.
All right, talking with Matt Hebert here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Just about wrapping this one up. Only a couple of minutes left, Matt. You get away from the racetrack for a little bit. You get a chance to go on a little vacation or just spend some time away. What are you going to do?
What am I going to do? I don't know. Fret about getting back to Actually, I took 2 days and I went to Gatlinburg. It was my buddy's bachelor party in Tennessee, and it was like 20 guys that I grew up with that I haven't seen, and probably some of them I haven't seen in 10, 15 years. So, you know, anytime I can see friends all my family's in Louisiana, so I don't get to see them that often. Anything with friends or family, man, I don't care where. We could be sitting in a double wide barbecue in the backyard and I'd be all right.
Do they all cheer for your horses too?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I spent a couple winters down at the Old Evangeline. So, you know, I would go to my grandma's house and eat and then immediately have to lay down and take a nap. So they follow it.
Well, Matt, before we let you go, what does the rest of the summer hold for you?
Well, I'm going to try to finish up the meet here at Lone Star, win a couple more races, and then we're going to give Ellis Park a go. I think we've got some improving stock. You know, I wouldn't go there if I thought I was going to get my head kicked in. So we'll go up to Ellis and try to make a little noise.
All right. Well, when you come through town, let me know, and we'll go out to dinner.
Absolutely, man. That'd be cool.
He's the next best thing to Charlie Whittingham.
Fatter, and I have hair.
Two for two.
Matt, listen, we really appreciate the visit. We'll remind people that if they did miss any portion of the show, they can simply go to our website, horseracingradio.net. They can check out the podcast whenever they get some time, and really appreciate you taking the time here with us today. A lot of fun. And if people are looking for an honest trainer, if they've learned anything from this past hour, you're their guy. Straight shooter.
I appreciate it. Thank you all very much.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Appreciate the visit. Yep. Matt Hebert here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. What a fun guy, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. Yeah, really fun. Really sharp.
Yeah. And never uttered a four-letter word.
No? No, we didn't have to hit
the... We can't say that about everybody.
The bleep button. That was very good. Yeah. No, great stuff. And, again, a huge Groupie Doll fan, as he worked with Buff for so many years. You can kind of see some of that Buff Bradley coming out in him a little bit, too, right? When he talks about how he approaches the game and how he approaches dealing with some of his clients, you can kind of see that coming out in him just a little bit.
Yeah, he's got that that mellow way of being that can kind of set people at ease, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, been a fun show. Our thanks to Matt Hebert for being with us for this past hour. Again, if you missed any portion, just go to our website. You can see all the interviews there with all of our Trainer Talk shows and Jock Talk and all the different programs we produce throughout the week. They're all there for you to listen to at your leisure. Been a fun hour, JT.
Yeah, it was great.
For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.